if we're not against them. Possibly. I took them off for a moment, but you're entitled to ask questions over there. Okay. So I want to begin by saying this is different than what I usually do. Whenever I talk for more than 15 minutes, I give up my chorus. First chief, the theory of that is that if I don't say anything worthwhile, you should have something worthwhile to read. I'm not going to do that tonight because I'm really hoping I say something worthwhile, and I want you focused on it just in case. I want to acknowledge up front that there are academic scholars who have done really important work in terms of understanding what modern orthodoxy is, both sociologically and ideologically. I want to specifically mention Alan Brill and Adam Frederiker. And to say that what I want to do tonight is not rigorous sociology, not rigorous history, but the best I could describe it as religio-political narrative, which in this context I hope is a fancy way of saying for it. What I want to do is tell an unfinished story and hope that you see yourself in the story, and I'm motivated to ensure that it continues in a way that makes you proud. I want to talk about the historical context of modern orthodoxy. I think the first thing anybody talks about when you talk about modern orthodoxy now is that it's losing. And for many years there was a perception that the way in which modern orthodoxy was losing is that there was the erosion to the right. So I want to try to analyze that. There are basically two ways that people frame the losing of modern orthodoxy, or critiques that are offered to explain it. One is the divide between ideological and sociological modern orthodoxy. Just to say there are only two communities, one of which is ideological commitments to certain intellectual propositions, to certain moral propositions, and is really framed around those issues, and another community which was simply framed by certain behaviors, often which the behaviors which were perceived as at least non-halachic, if not counter-halachic. And except right now, what I want to say is that all communities are built around coalitions. And just like political parties, and my political parties include people who have incompatible positions and are part of the party for various reasons. You have social conservatives, and you have foreign policy conservatives, there are religious conservatives, you have a whole gamut. And coalitions tend to unravel under severe stress. But to do very well as long as there's nothing that directly impacts ideology. So for example, conservative Judaism generally is perceived to have been a tremendous success for a significant period of time in America, precisely because it had no ideology, and was capable of creating a coalition of a vast array of behaviors that held together. And then when, really in the 80s, when people suddenly realized that the conservative Jewish coalition was on a behavior level, wasn't working anymore, the movement really ideologically split. Because there hadn't been a coherent ideology to bring it together. So the argument might be that modern orthodoxy, for a while, worked really well, and then at some point it became clear sociologically it wasn't working anywhere near as well, and so it became under threat. And under threat, we discovered that the coalition between ideological and sociological modern orthodoxy fell apart, and we have a community that sort of looks like the Republican Party. A second critique of modern orthodoxy, it's framed as that the reason that modern orthodoxy was losing was because it was not intentional in staffing its institutions. That is to say that when you take your educational institutions and you don't make sure that people who share your vision are the teachers in them, and over time you fail to reproduce yourself. So the second critique of modern orthodoxy, now there was a claim that the second critique was not really a function of intentionality, but a function of lack of capacity. That the reason that modern Orthodox institutions weren't staffed, as modern Orthodox educators say, is that there simply weren't enough educators at this caliber to staff them as officials. But I want to say I really think that wasn't true. I think that that had people wished to staff the institutions that way, there was more than enough talent, and it was often a conscious decision not to staff that way, which led to the failure. Now again, the perception was that the erosion of modern orthodoxy was to the right, as the children of modern orthodox parents grew up and identified Haredi. I think this perception has somewhat abated lately, owing at least partially because Richard Joel became president of NYU, and that created a sense, at least, what I would say is, how would you fair to describe it as stopping bleeding? rather than reversing the trend. We don't really get the same rhetoric about minorities actually losing to the right. We do have, however, for the past several years, I think it's fair to say that minority orthodoxy has been facing a new trend, which you might call erosion to the left. Whether one approves of it or not, you might think that that's a good thing, just as you might think erosion to the right is a good thing. You don't have to celebrate minority orthodoxy the way it was, but you have to be aware that whereas, I would say even 5 years ago, people still frame, like, why, if modern orthodoxy is losing numbers, it's because people are identifying right now, possibly because of the erosion of that coalition. I think that there's at least a level of erosion to what. So in the world of diverse training, we have issues about codes, et cetera, which instead of using the term modern orthodoxy, uses the term open orthodoxy, and genuinely perceives of its ideology as the true successor of past modern orthodoxy. As opposed to the part of orthodoxy, for example, it's still identified with BYU. You have the International Rabbinic Fellowship, which provides a professional context to the open orthodox ideology. But I think that for now, the key phenomenon that really needs to be addressed is not rabbinic institutions or rabbinic training institutions, but rather what I would call, I think, fairly an anti-clerical movement, right, which is what we call the independent community. Such as Elon, Cambridge, or Sheriff of Yerushalayim, or their phenomenon in New York. So, for example, over Shabbat, I had a conversation with somebody who said to me they were unclear what they identified with, quote, modern orthodoxy, or rather with, quote, liberal orthodoxy. And it seems to a sense that there is a community to the left of modern orthodoxy, which is competing for the same demographics. Now, these unions arise, I think, in part of a very genuine belief that modern orthodoxy does not live up to its own philosophy. And that will be addressed at length later on in the comments. But, okay, that's the introduction, I think, that we have to acknowledge the sociological context, which is generally seen as negative. And I want to point to a shift in that context, which is where the direction of erosion has moved from right to left. Whether or not you think this is a good thing or a bad thing, and say up front that the critique in both directions really is framed. The critique on the right is framed that people weren't living up to their halakhic principles. People weren't really fully observing halakha in the way that modern orthodoxy said it was doing this good. And the critique on the left is that modern orthodoxy wasn't living up to certain philosophic commitments. Okay. I want to start, because of the body of the share, I want to start with a story of Yerushalmi about a character whom all of you are familiar with, or at least the grandfather of the character all of you are familiar with, but the story is not often told in this way. So probably most of you are familiar with the story of Chani HaMagiel, Chani the Circle Maker, as it appears in the Mishnah and as it appears in the Babylonian Talmud. So in the Mishnah, the famous story of Chani HaMagiel is that he draws a circle on himself, so he becomes a circle maker, and refuses to move from there until God makes it rain, and eventually God makes it rain after a whole negotiation about the way in which it would rain. That is followed in the Babylonian Talmud by the more famous or friendly story in the Babylonian tradition of the Chani HaMagiel is put to sleep for 7 years, and he wakes up, sees the world in which his donkeys are given birth, the wheat fields have become olive fields, whatever, and they were a whole set around that. And that's pretty much, the story ends in a very depressing way, where he walks into the Beit Midrash, and nobody recognizes him. He asks for it, and one of the Beit Midrash says, wow, we learned as well now as when Chani HaMagiel was around. And he says, look, me, I'm Chani HaMagiel. But he can't prove it because everybody learns just as well as they did when he was around. So he doesn't change anything. So he says, I famous to El Chapusa Homi Tusa as a society, and he has a companionship for death, and God lets him die. Very depressing story. All it is organized around a particular verse, which is famous with the opening verse of the Psalm of Healing, which you open benching. Shiva Malod, the Shiva Shiva Shiva, the young Eden Tichomim, and then God restored the captivity of Zion, and like dreamers, and the captivity of Zion, the first captivity in rabbinic history, takes 7 years. So Chani HaMagiel sleeps for 7 years in order to try and give him an appreciation of how it could be that somebody could sleep for 7 years. Okay, Yerushalmi has a story which, in a sense, is much happier. if there's only something that Gil goes to sleep, working on a Gil grandfather goes to sleep, and wakes up, but in fact, but the world is not changing quite the same way. In fact, here's the story. Kanyan Agil was put to sleep the day of the destruction of the first temple. And he wakes up the day of the building of the second temple. So the 70 years in which he is asleep are the 70 years of Babylonian exile. And when he wakes up, he says to everybody, look, I'm Kanyan Agil. And they say, really? You're Kanyan Agil? We remember that when Kanyan Agil was around and he walked into the temple courtyard, the whole courtyard was light up. And he says, okay. And he walked into the down to the temple, walked into the courtyard, and the whole courtyard lights up. Okay, it's a very cheerful story, as opposed to the depressing Babylonian story. But what does it mean? I want to suggest what underlies it is Kanyan Agil. Why does God listen to Kanyan Agil when he says, I draw a circle around myself, it's not going to rain, I'm not moving to the circle until I rain. So in the Valley of the Gora, they say that because Kanyan Agil is like God's kid. Right? He's not like, you know, he's not, some people are like God's counselors, and Kanyan Agil is a member of the household. Kanyan Agil has a theology, which could not survive exile. He has a theology in which God has the right in which he can, right, he can say, I'm not leaving, and God will get it. Right? Like my children. You have to leave the airport, your kid says, no, I'm sorry, I have to leave, I'm going to draw your circle around myself until you give me a candy bar. I'm not getting on a plane. Alright, so, you know, kids live in a world in which there's no way you're getting on the plane without them, you're going to have to give me a candy bar. And your world is just totally shattered if you're trying to get on the plane and leave you in Milan, whatever it is. So Kanyan Agil, I think in this story, has a theology which cannot survive the exile. But because God loves him, he puts it to sleep. So he doesn't have to live through the events that undergrad that destroy his ideology. But unfortunately, we are not often shown that kind of subject. More often, right, if we have an ideology which is incapable of surviving reality, we are exposed to that reality. Sometimes we realize it immediately, and sometimes, through the different metaphor, we are in the position of Wile E. Coyote, over the cliff, but not yet looking down, as reality erodes the ground beneath us. So the radical claim in which I want to open the body of the speech is that these metaphors apply in large measure to my narcolepsy, meaning that in a variety of ways, we have failed to acknowledge or realize that our ideology has been mugged by historical or intellectual reality. The catchphrase for this is that we are trying to be non-orthodox in a postmodern world, but partially because I really don't like postmodernism so much, I want to try to argue that framing it solely around the issues of modernism and postmodernism would be an insufficient way of capturing what has happened to non-orthodox ideology. Okay. So I want to point out two ways in which the ideologies of the founding ideologies of non-orthodoxy have run into history. First is that one conventional way of portraying the foundational philosophies of non-orthodoxy is to say that the two goals are the Samson and Rachel Hirsch and the Hagami Cliff and Coyne Cook. Right, so these, I want to suggest that both the Hirsch in Germany with his Enlightenment Sayyidra ideology and Dr. Cook as in Israel with a strong Zionist ideology, what they both represent are poles of Hegelian belief in inexorable and inevitable progress. Research believes that humanity can be inexorably toward perfection towards the Enlightenment generally, and Cook believes that the world was tending inexorably towards perfection through Zionism, and through a particularly messianic form of Zionism. It's interesting to note that they actually came to radically opposite conclusions, such that Rafferty's anti-Zionism is every bit as critical a part of his worldview as Rafferty's Zionism. But I want to suggest that the Hirschian ideal of Torah and Derech Eretz, in that sense, right, as a Hegelian belief in the progress of humanity, is simply made untenable by the Holocaust. It just can't survive that. You can't have that kind of faith in covers. And Rukut's mechanism was made untenable, really, Rukut had this pacifistic mechanism, which was built earlier, in which Zionism would inevitably come about through universal recognition. And that really should have been made untenable by the initial messiness of the of Zionism. But even what we call the non-pacifistic adaptation of the standard Pre-Hiddah was, for me, and I think for most people who really think about it, it was made untenable by the outcome of the first Lebanon War, the kind of Shlomo Galil, in which became clear, even to those people who were caught up in 67 and somehow survived 73, and with the notion that there was some kind of inevitable historical progress and the Messianic era was right around the corner, that really couldn't survive the first war in Lebanon. And I always thought about my brother Zionism, this amazing meeting I had as part of the young students who were meeting with the old guard Mizrahi leadership, in which the conversation went, they kept on saying 1967, 1967, and we kept on saying Lebanon, and we're not incapable of communicating with each other. There's two other philosophic groundings among our sisters notice. One is an attempt to go right back to the Rambam and claim that we skipped basically the last 800 something years of Jewish history, that we are Lamanidians. And that seems to me not survivable because it requires one to believe that reason leads an extrapolate truth. And there, not for the smartest and postmodern, whatever you want, that's really, it's very hard for people to have that kind of faith in reason right now. I don't think that tends to work. And then, of course, you have Fritz Soloveitchik, who requires sort of a capacity to ignore history as it's usually understood. I have a critique of the usual understanding of him, but the vision of the road that became foundational for many modern Orthodox thinkers assumes the capacity to stand outside history, and that is also, I think, very difficult to maintain, aside from the and it works a lot better if we have particular commitments to particular schools of neo-Nazism, which are kind of uncommon. Now, what I want to say is, obviously, I am not trying to diminish or deny the enduring greatness and relevance of the Rosh Hashanah or Cook, let alone the Rambam. Their ideas have and continue to exert tremendous influence on me and pretty much everyone else who takes Judaism seriously. What I want to say is that, while they can, as with all other historical ideologies, be assimilated productively, they're not really capable of being foundational elements on their own. They're not modern to that. They don't fit with the contemporary practical and intellectual reality. Okay, that's for foundational philosophy. Second section I want to address is what I call foundational practical purposes. And what is modern orthodoxy supposed to be in people's lives? So for reasons that perhaps we should explore very later, I wanted to say, you always have to define your practical purposes in contrast to somebody else. Because somebody else accomplishes the same practical purposes than you do. And so I want to start by saying that the practical purposes should be contrasted with what we'll call for community to cover the orthodoxy. And three things that non-orthodoxy put in that were different. One is the belief in quote-unquote secular education. Second is a belief in what we'll call religious Zionism. And the third is a participation in and valuing of society around us. And with regard to those three, we have now just about universal secular education. While there is sometimes a perception that in the third world people don't get that education, that seems statistically to be deeply mistaken. That the degree, I saw once, but I'm not sure how accurate it is, which claims that the degree, degree of college education in the Sunni world is pretty much higher than the other subculture. So I think the notion that secular education has to happen, we have universal education for high school, we have almost universal college education. But we have that without, across communities, without any belief on the whole in the intrinsic value of that other. Right, so the practical purpose has been achieved, but without implementing the underlying value. What we have in terms of religious Zionism is we have near universal support for Israel, with the exception of the Jesuits.
I'm so sorry, but we're finishing up your presentation.
I didn't understand the line of that. I said that, so the practical purpose was that people should get secular education.
Okay.
And in terms of the practical issues, we want.
Okay.
Orthodox Jews get better education.
Right.
But the ideology behind that practical purpose was because sex education matters. Intrinsically, education matters. Knowing things matters.
Okay.
And so we ended up with everybody agreeing to get it. But even in the modern reflex community, sex education, of course, is perceived as a way to make a living. So they lost the idea. That's my take from my students. And certainly, I think a fair description of what goes on in issues of college, which is
okay.
Fairly larger. Religious Zionism, so we ended up with, this is a shift. Outside of historic character, you have support for Israel is pretty much universally seen as a prime value in the Orthodox community. But the notion that the state of Israel represents a spiritual opportunity, whether in a messianic sense, which derives to some degree, but in a sense with almost no content, I think, to it in terms of what society would be, or in the sense that I'm much happier with, which is that it creates a tremendous spiritual opportunity to realize Torah and take responsibility for whole society, that's very rare. They began to have the same phenomenon where the practical purpose was achieved, but the intellectual impetus behind it was not. And similarly, just as the notion of really forming a genuine enclave that you don't participate in society in any real sense, is very hard to sustain. Almost everybody has jobs in the secular world, but I would say we had a participation in society with almost no cultural sympathy or appreciation. Okay, so what I want to argue is that with regard to each of these goals, we have achieved practical success at the cost of at least significant ideological attenuation. And so we can't just take the ideology and apply it to new circumstances without reclaiming it. And determining to what extent we have fundamentally been changed ourselves, and it would indeed be a deep irony if one or two of us were incapable of responding to change. Since what happened is that the modern reflex community itself, right, at part, the irony is while first succeeding in any of its foundational technical purposes, where we can make claims we are all modern reflex, but the type of that perhaps was that you're building a coalition, so you start making practical arguments instead of ideological arguments. And it ends up that you're doing the same things you wanted to originally, but you no longer do them because of the reasons you were planning to. And so when you try and say, let's take who we are and just apply it to new circumstances, who you are isn't there anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
So, for example, it might be that you thought that the reason that you should, the reason that you should be a religious Zionist is because you really believe in responsibility and taking responsibility for a society. Right? And you thought that the whole vision was that Torah was supposed to be implemented across the broad society and not just the subsidiarity to people's internal spiritual life. And as it happened, when you were saying this, the major context in which you had responsibility for a society was in the building of the state of Israel and how you set up the internal Jewish community in the state of Israel. And then you have totally different realities. You have a state with power over minorities, which was not really an issue. Was not really an issue in the same way before 67, or at least wasn't realized. And you have a community with tremendous influence in America, in a way which certainly was not realized. Was not realized back then in the community that still largely saw itself as recovering from the Shoah. And if you're trying to say, well, ideologically, how do we respond to these new challenges as being genuinely influential in American society and figuring out how we build that influence, or being a settled state which has to address issues of internal justice as opposed to survival, we don't have the ideological resources left, right, that we can just say, oh, well, we all believe in, right, and that the purpose is to make as much of Torah possible real, as much as Torah as possible real, so let's just figure out how we do that in response to these new challenges. Because Zionism doesn't have that content anymore. Zionism is just support, right, it's just support for other Jews. I think that's it. Okay. So we have called foundational ideologies in a very deep sense, practical things. What were the purposes of the modern Orthodoxy if we were to frame it beyond the practical? So here I want to, you know, here again, the rebuttal was very close, tremendously helpful in just pointing it out in the article. So not to read Rabbi Wolfson's work for Gibraltar Colony ourselves, the article in Unorthodoxy in the Insight of the Original, the second edition of Encyclopedia Judaicus, which was in the early 1970s, and he says this about Unorthodoxy. Although many segments of Orthodoxy have veered away from the course of splendid isolation, unquote, which has been espoused by the right wing, they have not as yet been able to formulate a systematic theology capable of integrating the findings of modern science into dark scholarship. For that matter, there has not yet been developed a theory of evolution which has satisfied the demands of modern categories of thought. There are some isolated voices clamoring for less fundamentalist or mechanical approaches to revelation, which would utilize some of Martin Buber's notions and assign a large role for man's rejected response to the encounter with the divine, but it remains to be seen whether such a solution is feasible in the framework of orthodoxy. At any rate, he goes on to say, some of the widely recognized orthodox authorities unequivocally reject any approach like this. And then he says, secondly, he says, even more serious is the problem of the increasing resistance within orthodoxy to the orthodox emphasis on the authority of nature and all of that. This runs counter to the prevailing cultural emphasis upon pluralism and the individual's free subjective humanism. Right. That's pretty astonishing that, you know, you said in 1973, and, you know, all I'm going to do basically is go play that earlier, play that out. Because, I want to frame it as follows. I think that non-orthodoxy had four fundamental purposes. The first was to enable Jews, the Orthodox Jews, to live in intellectual integrity, meaning that you live with a lack of fear of ideas, and hopefully you have real answers to some of the real challenges posed by new ideas. Secondly, it's a purpose of moral integrity, which I'm defining as meaning living in a way that makes us proud of ourselves and feel whole. Thirdly, there was an idea of accessibility and accommodation, living without unnecessary burden. In traditional terms, it's beginning on how they want to live. Right, you're supposed to get benefits from this world. And so not creating unnecessary barriers to being able to live a pleasant life. And the fourth is outreach. Living in a way that attracts others, especially Jews, and offers them an entree to observe. Okay, so the four purposes are intellectual integrity, moral integrity, accessibility, and outreach. How are we doing? And what are the primary issues that we face in each of these areas? And are they significant enough in the lives of contemporary Jews that responding to them can be a catalyzing, unifying force and enable the rebuilding of non-orthodoxy? So in terms of social integrity, what I would say is that some issues have done really well on, particularly with regard to science. I think it's fair to say that evolution, the age of the universe, issues like that are no longer issues that threaten Jewish faith, despite the disturbing issue of the controversy of Rabbi Lipkin. But the pressing issues that remain are history, historicity of the Bible and how it relates to archaeological findings, and of course, not prior criticism of the documentary hypothesis, and various challenges to the divine authorship of the Bible, as well as the broad issue of how we integrate the value of autonomy. I think the first two are really the critical ones. The second issue, moral integrity. So I think we have significant practical achievements in terms of relationships with non-Jews, and I think the positions that we attribute to Rabbi Nachman Meiri, whether we attribute them correctly or not is a difference here, are generally practiced. But we have not succeeded, however, in adequately rooting those achievements, the practical achievements, intellectually and textually, and even rhetorically, so that once again, when you have issues come up in ways that have not been previously addressed, there isn't really an ideological resource that lets you adapt them. And issues for me, a contemporary issue that really pushes those buttons is the issue of reciprocity in terms of organ transplantation. Where people's modern reciprocity values aren't deeply bothered by the notion of setting a protocol which says you can accept transplants but not give them. Because we think there are ways to do it. They claim that you can't, on a formal level, you don't accept brain death, you can't give transplants. But they're already dead. So what are you doing about accepting them? Right. You can do it that way.
I don't think you can get the organs.
Well, definitely accept brain death. That was the international version. But you can go to the early Roman sites. and feel the various positions.
I tend to
restrict this position, but my problem is I'm not willing to accept the consequences of that, and I think that I'm not convinced that's going to measure anything. Anything that actually really correlates with the healthy definition of death. But if the consequence of that is an non-reciprocity, so I'm willing to make more medical arguments along the lines of the arguments being made harder now about whether the dead donor will have to be absolute. Or else then you can't accept that thing. No one is currently saying it.
Okay. And so the issues that remain, right, in other areas, I think we have acquiesced in the quiet obsolescence of any particular Jewish plan, particularly business, and on social justice issues, it is not common for Jews to feel that the religion constrains them from doing what they think is right, although that sometimes would be better if it did. So there's no tension either in the area of business or social justice where people say, well, this is what I really think should happen to Jews and stop me from doing that. It doesn't happen.
The pressing issues that do remain are gender egalitarianism and homosexuality. Although I would also note that there is at least one area where I think there is a lot more tension than usually acknowledged, which is that if your interview works with someone and ask them what their position is on abortion and compare it to what the public policy position is, you get a fairly giant chasm. And it just hasn't been talked about much. So it might be that there's work to be done there. I think that's one of the just areas where Orthodoxy has a huge gender divide, which is something I've been studying.
I think, you know, there's work we've read, we did a good practical job in terms of relations among Jews, an insufficient intellectual job. Other areas, I think, you know, regrettably, they just, you know, allow Jews to stop being a barrier to anything. And the real issues that are on the table now are gender egalitarianism and homosexuality. Okay, what about acceptability and accommodation? The truth is that right now, this just isn't an issue.
There's just no way that being an Orthodox Jew prevents you from being an effective, you know, participant in general society.
Isn't it right?
Yeah, I just, you know.
Going to ask for corporate solutions.
Better essence of corporate
questions.
Yeah, most of those. Yeah, I think that on a large scale, it's not given that non-Orthodoxy has anything specific to contribute to those. You don't get different answers from non-Orthodox rabbis, pretty rabbis. You find certain terms to use. It depends on how much it matters to you, how much money you're going to lose, things like that. I find it hard to see that non-Orthodoxy is anything really important to contribute, except making it more acceptable to appear in certain cultural events. Nor is it clear that we should be proud of the ways in which non-Orthodoxy is. Opera. Non-Orthodoxy has positions about Holy Shabbat, and make it easier to go to opera.
Okay. Sorry? Which I don't think is an example of that. It matters.
But it's hard to see that right now. Like, there's a giant community, for better or for worse, that really wants to go to opera, which feels great, which is living this divided life because they really want to go to opera. But they feel about it.
Maybe
we can yet make opera the ground of a new community. It might be a little limited, though. I'll be good at opera plus that way, I'm sure we'll get many more.
Singing, I think,
that there's, and that's a very good reason not better than our players. That, you know, you can walk through Queens and you can see advertisements for all sorts of women performances. Okay. So it's a therapy. And some of the issues here with, you know, whether you can go out, you know, whether you see it as a good idea to go out to viewers in particular bars or not, I don't know, but, you know, which you might find sociological reasons, and I'm not sure which way that would come out, depending on the type of bar you're, like, you know, I have biases in that bar, so, yeah.
Okay, outreach.
So, in terms of outreach, I think honestly you can tell musicians that we simply haven't demonstrated that we're pretty good at it. Kabbalah unquestionably does it really, really a lot better. So the notion that you have to have a video on Earth that comes really to outreach, I think it's just wiped out by the incredibly more successful model of Kabbalah in that regard. I think it's the most successful, and if you have the second most successful, it's probably Sarajin, and my left outreach does it better.
One might say that you're calling outreach in that case is actually missionary outreach. And there are other ways of doing that.
Okay. The question is,
the question is, does it work? You say, you know what, people don't get attracted to life and observance, right, unless you have other structures that present these models of integration that they want to be attracted to. I don't think that's empirically been demonstrated to be true. It would be nice.
By outreach, you mean bringing people who are not part of the
community. Yes. Or even bringing people to have an appreciation of what people are doing. It's been a long time since there was an NPR special on the headset being done by Monroe for that job. You get like 2 months we're in Sabalsk in New Orleans is likely to get some test ever set with. Some of that is just press, I think this is the reality that we also mention. I think that if we were to claim that our model is necessary for outreach, that is very hard to sustain right now. Because there's going to be doing it very differently and very successfully. And you might want to argue that we can do things they can't do. You might want to argue that we'd rather do it our way than their way. But we haven't demonstrated that. This is what we're supposed to accomplish. Right? That's what Marlowe is about. We haven't done. I think what you do, I think that there are undergraduate communities that are all through the magnet. And if we had stronger, right, and if we had stronger communities on various campuses, I think that we might very well succeed that way. But we haven't.
We could give out more free food,
that would also help. Just like the communication of our law school, is the way that producing those human happiness is most efficiently is provide free coffee. That can change the lives of the law school, right? Because now the law school has free coffee. It's not at all clear, right, we couldn't become like the most popular people in the world if instead of putting free Bibles in people's hotel rooms, it's a free coffee, right? It's a free coffee there, and all of a sudden, and my friend's not being with English. The toast of the world might not be that expensive. So they continue to take notes and start the coffee outreach model. So what I want to suggest then is that the pressing issue, that if we take those four as the original thing, and particularly take intellectual and moral integrity as the ones in which we had a unique contribution to make, and we'll demonstrate that we have a unique contribution to make, the issues that remain, really, are dealing with the core role of Bishatapana, with the sense of the Bible, and the significance of gender. Which is expressed both through egalitarianism and homosexuality, possibly with autonomy. And the question then is, right, so if you need if you're trying to rebuild modern orthodoxy, right, is there a basis for building this unity around the desire to engage these issues constructively rather than confrontationally? So here, for example, the model that Yehuda Mirsky attributed to Rav Kook in his dissertation. But you say that Rav Kook's pieces on evolution are not really because Rav Kook believes in evolution or cares about evolution, because Rav Kook thought that the role of an Orthodox philosopher is to find a way to demonstrate the compatibility of Orthodoxy with whatever stream of scientific thought was prevalent. Dr. David Schatz has written a recent piece which he argues the same thing on the basis of, and he says, I'm now going to do the same thing that Rav Kook did in evolution, in terms of various claims that neurochemistry makes the classic notion of free will impossible.
not that I don't believe in free will, but in case the science turns out to be true, we should have the philosophy ready to deal with it. Alright, so in that notion, alright, so the question is Vaishya, right, is this a, if you say that the remaining issues, right, that if you were taking a classical non-orthodox sensibility, the issues that you would need to address are the sanctity of Tanakh and the threat and the significance of gender, and you say what we want to do is we want to find a way to accommodate, right, religious tradition to a serious treatment of those issues, is that actually the way in which you're going to deal with unity? Or, alternatively, right, do we want to deal on the basis of we want this unity that addresses seriously the issues of Kishar Tanakh and the significance of right, and the significance of gender with specific relationships to homosexuality. Or whether we look at it and say, you know what, that's not a winning coalition. That's framing a framing movement around issues that have very limited popular appeal. And are not likely to get you where you want. And so therefore we need either to find a way of reframing the issues or finding new issues, as for example recreating a religious Zionism that's not messianic, which is a move that several people have tried. It wasn't being tried, it, the State Department does exactly work in that regard, but it hasn't in any way really significantly penetrated the community, because they were so we're rebuilding the movement around that kind of religiously responsible Zionism. Or we could try and say, you know what, there's a need for the approach to social justice. Right, which, you know, so far church approach to social justice has been largely equivalent to certain liberal positions. What would happen if we decided to stand with our staff to believe in favor of some term that has not been discredited, such as compassionate conservatism? Right, but some kind of notion of faith. I happen, for example, to be passionate about the idea that halakha is a tremendous push for workplace autonomy, and that, for example, there should be an orthodox voice in the healthcare debate pointing out that the whole notion of employer-based healthcare is a deep moral problem because it creates situations in which people are bound to their workplace. Right, and so there's a moral issue associated with employer-based healthcare, which we should be addressing very strongly. So maybe we could build a community which is around a unique approach to social justice. Or we could try and find a new mode of outreach and say, you know what, we haven't so far, but we're now going to see, you know, we now say we want to be an outreach community, and we're not going to do it in the manner which Chabad is stereotyped for doing, although those of us who live in Cambridge know that there are other models of Chabad that don't, right, that don't use that at all. So we could try that. And I think that's a real issue we need to think about. We need to understand that on the axis of intellectual and moral integrity, it's not clear that the issues that remain are winning issues. Okay. There's a second set of questions I want to ask, which impinges, I think, substantially on the first, which is what kind of group non-orthodox you ought to be. So here I want to read briefly from Rabbi Rechten, article on non-orthodoxy, which I think is first in the current, which he says, quote, the non-orthodox constitute neither sect, Emmanuel Rechten. As the non-orthodox constitute neither sect nor movement, they convene the seminars and colloquiums. They have no organized group and no publication of their own. There is no list of rabbis or laymen who call themselves non-orthodox. They are best represented by a group of rabbis who see each other from time to time and share the same commitment, namely the Torah does not have to be afraid of modernity, since there is no challenge the Torah cannot cope with. Some prefer the term centrist because the word modern is too often associated with centrism. Others reject the term centrist because it suggests being on the center of all issues, whereas non-orthodox are extremists on the positive side of any issues, such as the centrality of ethics and religious behavior, and the need for improving the status of women in halakha. Now the issue that whether we think his sociological description is right is accurate or not, that depends on his identifying non-orthodox as a particular ideological thing which would exclude all these university institutions from being part of it. So that's what he makes his claim. And you might argue that his Bachelor of Rabbinic Fellowship, for example, is a response to that. But I want to address just this opening statement, which is non-orthodox constitute neither sect nor movement. What does that mean? I want to suggest that really there are three possibilities as to what non-orthodoxy could be, which I will frame as denomination, sect, or movement. And the difference among these is what frame of reference we adopt. What the external parameters are that we take as given, which we see as the framework within which we have to exist. Or another way of saying that, is there a group with whom we would move if they move? Because we want to be part of them. So a denomination sets its boundaries by the Jewish religion generally. As currently constituted, that means that we would be constrained from belief in a particular day of Messiah, although the Jewish seems to be otherwise constrained from belief in all day of Messiah. within that boundary, apparently it's like all dead messiahs who have been dead for more than 30 years or within that boundary, a denomination pays no necessary attention to the things of the denomination. Okay, so do you ask, what are the external parameters within which Reform Judaism has to move? The answer is, it pretty much has to move within parameters that let the other denominations recognize it as Jewish. And as long as people will not, right or wrong, right, I think it's a good idea, that idea that doesn't constrain it at all, but constrains it, but if somebody starts saying, well, we think you're really not Jewish, that causes a major digressive, because they're very excited about that. And that's the founder that probably they see themselves as controlling. But within that boundary, that denomination just, for example, somebody's going to think, well, most Jews think this, therefore we should think this too, right? You don't take votes in which members of other denominations are open to. So the modern orthodoxy becomes a denomination. So then that would be the only constraint. You can do whatever you want, as long as people will still think what you're doing is Jewish. Second topic really is a sect. Right? So sect sets its boundaries by the Orthodox denomination, which is much more restrictive. Right? One of the effects of orthodoxy, that means you can only engage in behavior that will be recognized by the rest of orthodoxy as orthodox. Now, if you nonetheless define yourself as a sect, then so long as you're still orthodox, you can ignore the philosophical opinions of everybody else. So, for example, it's a faith group, right? If you're already talking in a particular way, so who cares if that's a minority position and everyone else talking in a different way? So what if you're a sect, right? The idea of the sect is that you engage in internal discourse which is framed only by the boundaries of other people recognize that what you are doing is essentially an orthodox discourse. That's another model on orthodoxy could take, which is to say that, we don't see ourselves as engaged in halakhic dialogue with the rest of orthodoxy. But we see ourselves as being orthodox. It matters to us that we be perceived as orthodox, and we understand that imposes a significant restraint. But within that, we're not going to allow majority rule. When we're writing Shavuot, we're not going to start saying, well, the Mincha Pitzchak, or other Haredi folks can say this. And so the question now is, can we rely on Rav Nachman from Peter Lincoln, against Rav Stein White or any other kind? I said, no. They talk to their community, our community, the folks in our attention, whoever you think the current establishment is in there is not. I don't want to start getting political by something by listening in. So that's also an option. So one of the issues, so we don't have enough of those. But if we just cleared ourselves, certain people would suddenly gain a lot more stature. I think that we're happy. We can make that decision, but I think there are two major challenges here. The first is halachic issue that same as what you're going to do, which is I understand that according to Rashi means that there is a prohibition against unnecessarily factionalizing the different community. Meaning that there is a strong preference halachically for there to be a unified authority structure as much as possible within the observing community, how about the function nationally. And so if you have to declare yourself a sect, you have to have some really powerful force telling you that I cannot in good conscience follow the positions of the other groups. Okay. You might think you didn't meet that. I think it's a threshold you have to meet, right? That the issues that you otherwise have to give in on are so important to you that you're not willing to be part of the process. You have to think of intent now to arguing for secession under the American Constitution. Okay, that's no longer a live issue now, in the sense that the Civil War settled it, and no one's going to try it anymore because the power
right? It's not a practical power thing right now, but that doesn't set out yet. But in the or it's around Alaska, I think. But in the but in the 19th century, everyone understood it was a big move to argue for nullification and secession. But the movie could only take for the most extreme issues, but it was so important to embrace, but nonetheless you could do it. You have to decide if the issues that fit modern orthodoxy are that way. A second issue in terms of being a sect as opposed to a denomination is that regrettably the definitions are not autonomously imposed. Rather, you can't say I declare myself orthodox, therefore I'm an orthodox sect, and now I can't know the rest of you. The definitions are imposed by the other, right? You have to get the other members of the group to accept your own definition. And so you don't have that kind of way to declare yourself a sect. You don't have that kind of freedom, because if the rest of the group comes to and says, that thing that you want to do, we rule it non-orthodox, and you're stuck. Now, the only way really to prevent that happening is, right, the same way as any coalition, is if the other group really, really doesn't want to lose it. So for example, right now an issue which might be on the issue of mechanism in Chabad, the cost to orthodoxy of excluding Chabad in terms of lifestyle is so great, and in terms of what one sees people as being outreached to, that Chabad is, in a sense right now, the tail that wags the dog, and you know, and I think Dr. Berger may be right, is, you know, there's a serious risk it will become the dog that wags the tail. It's just not possible. It would be a tremendous loss if on earth that we chose to tell Chabad, either you expel the messiness or we expel you. Whether you think they should or shouldn't, right? Whether you think it's the right opinion or the wrong opinion, you just can't do it right now politically. It's really, right? It would be really deep in that way. You know, for example, until recently, it would have meant that you had no kosher meat. And right, last I heard on earth that even training that as a shokin. Right, to replace the Bad Shilkin. I know of one member of Bad Shilkin in trade. And he wants to do, like, you know, high class or getting and he wants to be, you know, doing justice in a factory. So the issue is that if we declared ourselves a sect, right, would we in fact be able to keep the rest of orthodoxy from considering up the denomination instead? And it's not clear to me that we have the influence right now to pull it off, and we pull enough people through it. Furthermore, if we took the issues of Sushatana and genders are better, how would we define ourselves? If we define ourselves by specific halakhic conclusions, then I think there would be in the monoshach, an argument either way. Either we would assimilate to gender Judaism because our halakhic conclusions would not differ from theirs. But if we reach the halakhic conclusion that we allow full egalitarianism and we don't in any way condemn same-sex relationships. So then, what are we doing? Practically, we are indistinguishable on the adult level. Because we assimilate to Judaism, we would lose a large part of our constituency. I'm talking purely in practical terms. And then, in my own terms, I would say we lose a large part of halakhic integrity. Or else we would not reach those specific welfare conclusions, then we would fail to satisfy a large part of our constituency. I would suggest that in movement, the denomination of a sect can't long maintain itself purely on what I would call an aspirational definition. Right? We're the group that wants people to talk to him that way, but can't. That doesn't seem to me to be like, you know, the banner to which people flock to. Right? We're the people who don't fight the holistic lives because we don't really do the things we believe. Now this is, I should say, the approach taking gender specifically as the issue is the approach of the independent union. And the question is whether a group that takes that as its banner has, you know, has survivability halakhically. And my argument, may try to be wrong, is that the answer is that in the current circumstances, the group of modern orthodoxy that wishes to define itself specifically around that issue does not have either the scholarship or the ideological commitment to sustain all these forms in isolation. And this is before they address the issue of homosexuality, and without dealing in any, without on the whole, with the exception of Marafa's work, of dealing with the issue of the fact that it's not in a sustained way.
Could you
I think the pressure,
there's been a lot of forms of isolation, right? I think the question is, you know, we're a group, right? We're a group which defines ourselves as orthodox. We'd like other people to accept ourselves, to accept us that way. And we're at least defining ourselves as alive. The opinions of other people who disagree with us are irrelevant to us, except that we would like them to regard us as philosophy and orthodox. Right? And we're not, there are things we are not doing because even though we think they are right, because we want to maintain halakhic form. Right? So reforming is an aspirational definition. We do more than other people do, right? Not as much as other people do, although in principle we agree that we should.
We don't count them as any, but we wait for Kennedy's.
Right? We let them in, but not ours. Right? I don't see that as a stable situation. I don't think that the demographic that's there is capable of maintaining it.
If you're just defined by yourself,
are you just the people who do that? Are you actually going to be able to continue to say, well, we make decisions because this is halakhic and this is not? Right, in a serious way.
Without
losing our intellectual integrity. Or without assimilating immediately to convert to Judaism. I don't believe it. I don't see it as doable. I don't think the demographic that goes there can go there. Meaning you declare yourself a sect or denomination, right? But everything outside is irrelevant. You make your decisions only based on people who share your prior commitment.
And what do you mean when they can't sustain that?
In 15 years, is that still going to be a group that maintains its independence and is not assimilated to, right, to groups that don't take all the forms of the same theory?
Okay.
I also want to point out, if you want to take that, one of the issues that specifically Hovind has raised in terms of open orthodoxy, which I think is very powerful, is the argument that there should be a group of orthodoxy which is particularly open to dialogue with non-orthodox Jews. The problem with that is that only matters so long as you're considered orthodox. If you stop being part of orthodoxy, then your willingness to engage in dialogue with non-orthodox Jews becomes kind of silly because you're talking to yourself. And so it's all very well and good. It's all very well and good if you say, well, I don't see myself that way. Right? But if they're not carrying any significant unity with you, right? The whole value is a group that is accepted as orthodox and nonetheless being willing to talk outside orthodoxy. So defining yourself by that purpose means that you have to accept the parameters of, right, the parameters of being accepted, at least. There's a third option. And the third option is to be a movement. Right? Well, let's just say being a movement is, right, a movement is not a group that sees itself as independent. A movement is a group that sees itself as seeking to influence a larger group. A movement is something within groups as opposed to a group on its own. Movements are less required to reach conclusions. Right? In a denomination, you have to have your own synagogue, and your synagogues have to have rituals. In a movement, you can say, we want the decision about what the ritual should be to be grounded in on certain principles. That's, for example, you have to take serious account of what women want and make sure that your principles are compatible with recognizing women as human beings, et cetera. So as a movement, right, you're less required to reach conclusions, you don't need your own communal institutions, and you can make pragmatic choices about when to stay within particular denominations of sex and to what extent. So, for example, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Association is an excellent example of a movement. It makes choices about the extent. It makes choices about the extent to which it wishes to be a movement within orthodoxy or within Judaism as a whole. Right? There are interesting choices it has to make those choices continually, but it makes a decision, right, that it wants to be a movement. And I think that if not orthodoxy chose to be a movement, it would have to make the same sorts of choices. Does it wish to be a movement within orthodoxy or a movement within Judaism? Along the same lines as the independent Yanim are now making choices about whether they wish to be independent Yanim, which is associated with all their orthodox independent Yanim,
or whether, if you can't see the current trend, you have an association in the Dominion, which includes a wide spectrum of factors, which some of which certainly is not in any way acknowledged within this current framework of orthodoxy as orthodox. Right? That will not, so unorthodox movement would have to make the same kinds of choices. If you define yourself as a movement, and you have to decide, the two models I would say, for these purposes, metaphors, are do you want to be an Apple or a Microsoft? Right? Do you want to be a movement that comes up with a cool idea that influences the opinion leaders and other groups, that eventually trickles down and eventually the mass movement copy views? Right, or do you want to try and track lots and lots of people? Right, that's right. So it's the Apple to Microsoft model. I think we would need to be both. But I did, right, we have to figure out, you know, how you frame the same ideas in both populist and elite form. And if you're talking, you know, how you frame intellectual integrity as a mass concept, how you teach it. You know, for me, the issue of both perspectives, you know, the one time when I had the, I made a mistake in engineering for a show, which I probably hired somebody much, much more competent than me. But the reason for the place time I realized that this was not really the job for me at the time, at least in my life, was when I gave this long, you know, after what you're all about, I gave this, you know, very complicated, not orthodox thing about struggling with moral issues, and one of the people that looked at me and said, so what would you tell my 7-year-old? And I had no answer. It was just utterly dumb. Moral trouble. How am I running an elementary education on the basis of moral struggle and dealing with conflict?
Well, I think the impression
just
explains what you tell your
family. Yeah. So now, at that time in my life, now having 9-year-old just to tell you all that I've gone through this, and I might have a better answer to that question than I did back. But at that point, I was wholly incompetent to answer that question, and therefore it should not have been the rather ritual that had 7-year-old or 5-year-old. So I think you have to challenge with not saying how much minor orthodoxy has that. So I guess the tentative conclusion I'm reaching is, and it's an analysis that tends in a particular direction which doesn't make me happy. I would be, in a sense, happier if I could say, well, what we need to do is recapture the institutions of the movement. And I think that's what I argued for a long time. You know, we need to, or build new institutions. And it's important that there be institutions. It's really important that there be institutions. But if you ask me right now, I don't think we have a winning set of ideas that are capable of forming a denomination or a sect. We haven't worked out the ideas well enough on the ones that matter to us. So my regrettable judgment right now is that we are much better off functioning as a movement than either a sect or a denomination, and that frames all sorts of choices. It frames choices about how far you can go. It frames choices about whether you can make lots of decisions without caring about the opinions of others. It makes choices about the extent to which you can set up your own conversion standards, all sorts of issues like that. Anyway, so I want to discuss about this as a deliberate provocation. If it generates responses of people saying, no, we have to create, we can't function within the rest, we have to be independent, that's fine. I just want to challenge the people who want to say that and formulate exactly how they intend to do that in a way which is survival. And I thank you very, very much for allowing me to talk to such a
Yes,
sir. The issue that there is seems to be minor activity when our successful possibly and limiting in the mechanics of the same individual and really managing the pain and such differences that are going there. And that's part of the issue being here, the state of the conflict, which is better or not.
I don't know enough about what, I used to be very, very depressed about what happened with, what happened to Orthodox Jews in Israel. The sort of comedy routine about Israel is this place where non-Orthodox influence wants to become irrelevant. I think that's less true than it was. And certainly, part of that was my failure to be fully aware of what was going on in Israel. It's certainly true institutionally. And non-orthodoxy doesn't control the world of it, doesn't control the religious court system, doesn't control anything that I can see. So is there the kernel of a movement there? Yeah.
but I'm still framed around and not getting, you know, as few as most of the taxi drivers party. When it was founded, but I need a lot of students to before I believe
it's all that wrong.
I think that's true. And I think that what it's
like... And the whole conference itself is really dependent on the amount of joining it, and having the ideal of how they got, and the idealism
of how they got started. Yeah, I do think that as a pragmatic measure, one of the things that really needs to happen is for non-Orthodoxy to frame itself as both an Israel and diaspora movement and come up with an ideological formulation that unifies them. Because one of the things that fell apart was people thought that non-Orthodoxy and Dafil and me were the same thing, and at some point woke up and realized that Dafil and me was a Haredi Mepinite movement, and which had nothing in common with what non-Orthodoxy was doing in America, except the extent that we adopted that form of Zionism. And that, you know, says, you know, which then is a really good awakening when the revenue starts toppling your gears. And that's probably when I start consolidating your conversion. Right? And, you know, Joe all of a sudden woke up and realized that we weren't talking about allies and friends at all. We were talking about, you know, a community that, on terms of most issues, it matters to you on the other side. And didn't identify with them in any way. And you identified with them, but they didn't identify with you. Right, you know, a community that came over and was utterly baffled by the fact that you remember learning Gemara seriously. Right, the people you were, that you thought were representing your ideology, that really had no conception of what your religious life was like. And so if Gemara Orthodoxy is going to succeed at any form, I think it needs to formulate a set of ideas that will resonate across. And so here, I guess I should talk, you know, those of you don't know, I wrote something called Center of Monster Religious, which is trying to be the intellectual engine for modern orthodoxy. And one of the ambitions that really has is to run a full year, what centers these two programs, the full year program that brings American and Israelis together to think about contemporary issues and to be conservative, because I think it has to happen with Americans and Israelis together. I think that you know, it has to develop in parallel, it won't go anywhere.
Can you explain briefly the significance of the moving on to credit of why you were? I have no idea what that means or what it suggests.
I think, it's the very first step that I take. What I think is that he has succeeded. I think, what he did was largely was to deflect the, by expanding the, by vastly expanding the number of resources available. So firstly, it used to be really scarce competition for positions, and that got, right, and that became just very, really harsh. All of a sudden, there were a lot more positions. And so you could appoint people, you could appoint more varied groups. And secondly, he created the center of the future, which doesn't end around the issue in some ways. And created a way. So he created very effectively, I think. He created things that certainly didn't look standard Haredi, but also were non-threatening. I think the
creating conditions
for modern. Yeah, I think it's, he just did a very good job of non-confrontationally creating a space within an institution that has been very constricted. Creating new spaces where people who otherwise wouldn't squeeze out could still be very confined, creating environments where, let's say, I know it was a wonderful trip, we take Rosh Hashiva to Israel to study the Shmita. And along with that, right, you get to meet a variety of people and discover that you can't talk about Shmita without talking about economics. But nobody would say that, you know, the moderate stuff thing to see how Shmita functions. And so people get to know different perceptions. So along the way, now you have the idea integrated that economics matters, which otherwise might not have penetrated into the issue. And that's, you know, kind of an equity and non-orthodox idea.
in that sense.
Being able to bring
these
people in the decision that
yeah. I think it deserves a lot of credit. I think Wade is a different place. It's much easier to identify on Earth and see a career path and be not see yourself as being in direct conflict with all your teachers, which I think was the case. Extremely the case my first time to issue was 24 years ago. Less extremely the case by the time I graduated 50 years ago, I guess. And much less the case now.
And from your point of view, as to the pattern, why you would essentially align with this recording of the creation?
I think it was aligned with the erosion. Alright, whether people, I don't think people came in and came out for it. It was aligned with the erosion of self-confidence in a lot of us students. People came out really not confident in the right, you know, really with the belief that if they would have maintained these positions, they were doing so against the mother. Right, you may not change totally, but you would just hear them, that's the community we wrote. How you would choose to make by educating your children, we would ask your child to. Right, all those things that we did in them would contribute to the erosion of the family. Yes, ma'am. I think that writing helps. If it is written work, people read them, and if they're good, they're good. I think that helps. I think that producing people identify with their communities and people can't, without having the dirty glasses on, can't look at them and say, wow. And say, wow, that's a really fun person. I don't think you can do better than be who you are has to be good enough, and the public relations. Hopefully you have enough talent to get people to see who you really are.
Is there a form of content written once a month in different Orthodox branches?
No. But things get published, and hopefully people read them. Things get published. It would be great if they had a popular press also. There is no way for a fairy lady to read Orthodox works, because there's no way for an Orthodox lady to read Orthodox works. Because we have no Peter, we have no Kumash. Right? That's just a failure. And pretty much, I think everyone has recognized the last 30 years that we need to fix this. Part of the problem is that we have to be able to fix it is because, let's say, Samash, nobody could figure out how to deal with that Dr. Fairfax's issues. And so that's Dr. Fairfax's divine authorship of, right, nobody could figure out how to deal with them, so rather than deal with it, they just let the project go. And why does Peter never have to do this beyond me?
What happens when your first
thought is
that you tell
us they are strong? Well, they have to figure it. I had much more respect for our school than people were, and their school does a good job at a whole lot of things. And it might be that you could write that if somebody sponsored it, that they would write that they would put out a Fred Rankin's response, and I would strongly encourage people who don't have to try and explore this. That there should be a biography of the Rav, and maybe the whole controversy of the Jewish observers acronyms on the Rav site can be settled by having a biography of the Rav. I think that's part of having it. It said VL instead of VTO. And that caused a huge controversy. It was not good at all. In the Jewish Observer. I saw the same people, but I think that's on the whole. It is by a whole bunch of white guys. It really is. I haven't addressed the question of strategic error. The question of whether that why you like JCS, realize way too late that that you could educate people where they were. It's supposed to bring everyone to New York, and that was a model that either Monroe Carter got right, and considered the Monroe Carter got wrong. Yeah, you can only bring people to the central city to be educated if they have no major, if they have no educational opportunities where they are. And if somebody else is setting up the educational opportunities where they are, then you're just going to lose them because people aren't going to come. That was a strategic error, which, again, President Joel was remedying that. I can say, I fought for that 15 years ago, and I lost, and now it's happening.
She doesn't
even branch it, from the opening polls, community polls in Chicago, and six other places where you're. That's something as outreach calls. The call as a whole, right? The Freddy call often, that's not an outreach thing as often did. And the notion of a local call, the purpose is for people to sit and learn as opposed to sit and learn with the community, is not right. That is almost every community now. I think one of Brighton defines itself as an outreach call now.
Was it Lakewood or outreach?
Lakewood is university. But the community schools now are not, community schools now are outreach schools, and why are you doing that now too? With Lake. But there. Beginning the summer program, all sorts of things like that. The high school summer program. That are deliberately designed to socialize people into your community. And that, that never happened, it was a sad thing. But now I just spent some of last week, maybe it'll happen this year, finally. We'll see.
Let me ask you
a
kind of more theoretical question. You talked about the idea that reason we can make the truth of being a false premise.
Yeah.
Could you unpack that a little bit?
I think that, I couldn't check the book better, I think the notion that you can't reach false conclusions through reason, because all untrue systems would contradict themselves in discoverable ways. And therefore, if you argue reasonably, you would come to truth, because coherence and correspondence are the same thing. Right? That's I think, a strong medieval notion. Right, that one is based on. But if you use your intellect properly, you will not reach falsehood. Whereas the contemporary, as it generally is, it depends on what kind of thing you start with, and there's no reason you can't build as coherent a system as any other on the basis of false predicates.
In that model,
you
have ground truth, because you're talking about it sort of being there and reaching the truth.
Yeah, so that model, you have much more, you don't have that kind of certainty with any single epistemology. I think that's where I am. I think it's very hard for... There's one yeshiva, right? Yeshiva Penekor in Farakwe, that is trying to restore the Rambam. And there are some students to each other, still believe that you can reason, you can not only reason from first principles, but you can determine correct first principles on the basis of reason. I don't think that's likely to spread.
Okay.
I think it just runs into, I guess the easy argument I would make is, the reason it doesn't survive university students is because they need people who are equally smart, or smarter than they are, who don't reach the same conclusions they do. It's the kind of idea that really survives largely only in isolation to some degree. Right, if you believe, I can't say done to them because, it reminds me of the Ayn Rand phenomenon. Because Ayn Rand followers also were of the position, and still are of the position, that they can achieve first principles through reason. And there are Aristotelians, right? So, maybe Aristotelianism will make a comeback. I was Platonist will make I'm not interested in seeing Aristotle will make a comeback. Not Plato make a comeback. I'll be a much happier person.
I've always expansionism and institutions, and
given possibilities that now you're thinking of a period of retrenchment, there is an opportunity for modern orthodoxy as a more practical approach, I think a more flexible approach to living in a world and reconciling our urban schools.
So if you're spirit, I mean, we've had acceptance before in the 80s and the 90s and all that kind of thing, but that doesn't seem to have slowed down the priority call a little
bit. Yeah, I would argue differently. I think
I'm also thinking about, and I tend not to think in terms of
No, I think it's really interesting there. I think pragmatically, I think it's wrong. As I would say, there is no call a woman. And there's generally the whole movement such doesn't exist in that way. Israel does, but in America, no, it's already called a movement. Already called a movement is an outreach professional movement now. All right, it's very explicit. There isn't a really strong culture of people who keep learning after 25 or 26. That's a very small segment of the population. And the truth is, an unorthodox culture requires vastly higher incomes than Israeli culture does. We require schools that are radically more expensive. We expect our kids to go to Ivy League colleges or private colleges and not to Brooklyn College. It's not at all clear to me in that an economic retrenchment that unorthodoxy as currently constituted does better than the trading model. The first simple thing simply is that it's perfectly possible, so it can be socially difficult to be already and somewhat poor, and just about impossible to be unorthodox and poor. Just about impossible. It's too much, right? Too many things you have to do. So I'm not at all convinced that, you know, there have been many predictions that, you know, clearly when the Rice Center went bankrupt briefly, that people said, look, you're pulling, you know, $100 million out of the economy. And I think they'd be fooled in ways. I think that the shift from average model is, influenced by Chabad also, is a direct response to the economics. But it's not at all clear to me that my orthodoxy is a more viable economic model. And again, that's one of the stories my brother always told me, that he dealt with a fundraiser at the Yeshiva. And the fundraiser said, look, we have two choices in terms of sustaining our institution. We could train everybody to be a professional, which is what my orthodox day schools do, or we can train everybody to go into business. Right. If we train everybody to be professional, then everybody makes $100,000 a year and has $5,000 of disposable income. So we get $50,000 a year. If we train everyone to be a businessman, and then nine of them make $50,000 a year of no disposable income, and one of them makes $1 million. And he has $90,000 of disposable income. So we get $90,000 a year. Any economic model tells you that if you want to sustain cultural institutions, what you want to become inequality. Right. Cultural capital is very skewed. The money that sustains cultural institutions comes from the rich, and not from the middle class. And right, if you create a culture of the middle class, that's not all clear to me that we do better than the majority world does. Not maybe it's true, but I don't see it as a sign. Education. I think that is one neighborhood. Housing in honor of those neighborhoods is wildly expensive right now. And people. You want to live in here? So as a matter of fact, it's sociologically concentrated right now. People live in concentrated neighborhoods. Now you might say that's not, you know, it's peculiar. I was very puzzled when I went to Phoenix and discovered that modern orthodoxy meant living in an entirely self-contained neighborhood in which there are no Gentiles and you walk down the middle of the street. You know, this should be a stereotype. It's a stereotype of Buzzfeed, that's Phoenix. But I think that, you know, that there's people with economic expectations, including vacations, and holidays and hotels. It's a wealthy community. It's a fabulously wealthy community. Public education is a symptom of what kind of lifestyle you expect for your kids. And it would take...
It's contributing significantly in your
I think if you...
would be necessary to say anything.
If you ask me where the Monarch Left community right now is, right, which community is likely... it spends a lot of money on vacations and on toys and on cars and on houses. And
we wouldn't have to do that to maintain
if we take a whole shift in which you think which would happen when you're in when you're in an economic downturn, what has to happen is that the vacations go and not the day school. Not at all. I'm not convinced that we handle a kind of, we handle a downturn by concentrating our resources on the essentials.
If that's the case, you just touched upon something that's very close to the center of the entire larger picture, which is what this community sector would want, this is a community. Considered essential, and the way what you're saying is that this little notion of what's essential does not correspond with your notion of what they should.
Well, if we go back to the ideological versus sociological on our book, I think that we haven't built a community on the whole that has the ideals of the ideological community, and so that's why if we had that, then we would be in a much stronger position sociologically, but we don't. Honestly, if you don't have that, then we have to, that's why I think
so. So that's why education falls into the ideological category.
Certain kinds of
education.
Certain kinds of education. I don't think the honors left state, when the budget cuts come, then will the honors left school say, well, we can downgrade science labs. So we have to keep some education at the same level. I don't think you can argue anymore that you have to have top level day schools to get to make a living. It doesn't seem to be empirically true. I don't know the reason that kind of deep recession. But it would be nice if there were a recession that the response was an unrest that became a much more attractive option, but it's not clear to me that would be the case. It's more likely to me that what happened is that people who were poor would have to pull their kids out of Monarch Plus day schools and send them to Friday day schools. Because Monarch Plus schools aren't willing to compromise their level of education to account for lower economic circumstances. You'll pull your kids in, I'll tell you for myself, right? Mm-hmm. We're considering spending your kids, first of all, I like 30 summer camp, I like the 30 summer camp, but also it's a lot cheaper. It's a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense for us, we are not in the standard demographic. It makes sense for us to consider spending our kids in more
areas. Why is it a lot cheaper?
Because they're not as interested in building fancy facilities. Because they're not as interested in well-roundedness. Because they're not interested in well-roundedness. And because the plan is because support is so much greater expense. Because they're not model, much less is expected of the, a much lower percentage is expected from the standard price. It's a model built on inequality, not inequality. There are all sorts of justice issues which make that problematic. But in terms of economic survival, we're turning downstream. We have a much less, everyone has much less disposable income, income to spend, you go to zero, as opposed to the wealthy where you still have quite a bit left. I mean, I'm not an economist. That's my offhand thing. I'm not looking forward to a revival on our reflexive result in economic decline.
All right. Thank you very much. Last question. Okay.
Yeah, this is a procedural question. Will we be able to read this?
This is not currently leaking out then.
I hope it came out.
So I hope this will be able to play tomorrow. And I would say that this is very helpful for me. I'm not happy enough with it yet. Just in writing, which is the final form. So I'm hoping that I'll get a lot of feedback about this, and that you'll tell everyone to go to the website and write to me, and then eventually various written versions of this will emerge.
Well, here's my, should be on the website. Thank you very much.